Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Hilton Dean's Gate in Manchester on a fairly damp, typically Manchester evening in November. Sessional meeting tonight, and I'm the chair, and I'm hoping that you're going to do all the talking about me. But a few points of order first. Copies of the minutes of the ordinary general meeting held on 2nd of November 2009 have been displayed on the Institute Notice Board and will be taken as read unless anybody wishes to comment otherwise. But if not, may I sign the minutes as a correct record? I will take the deafening silence as a yes. I would like to welcome all guests here tonight and personal guests and members. As I said, there's a few housekeeping issues before we start with the real purpose of tonight's meeting. The fire alarm for this building is a continuous ringing alarm. Should this go off during the meeting, please make your way calmly and efficiently through the nearest fire exit. Hotel staff members will be on hand to direct you to the assembly point opposite the hotel. Anyone wishing to claim CPD for this meeting should sign the forms at the reception desk. These are for auditing purposes only. You are also now responsible for entering CPD on your own online records because Institute staff will no longer be doing this for you. And finally, may I ask that you turn off your mobile phones and BlackBerries as they interfere with the sound system. It's not sufficient just to mute the ringing tone, as your phone or BlackBerry will still try to talk to its face, and this is picked up by the equipment. So without further ado, I will invite Elliot Barnell to give a presentation on his paper entitled Economic Scenario Generators and Solvency II.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chief Charles. Good evening, everybody. This is the agenda that I've put up for tonight. I guess we could assume that everyone's read through the paper in detail, but I'm assuming that there will be some people in the audience who might not have gone through everything, so I'm going to try and spend maybe a little bit longer on the presentation this evening. 25, 35 minutes, just to bring everybody up to speed. What I'm also going to try and do, and one of the interesting things about doing this particular paper, I should say, is that it's actually in some ways been a moving target. As one writes a chapter, then there's a new bunch of CPs come out, or there's a new bit of advice comes out, and so there's some new things which could have been inserted. So I've got a few extra slides, a few extra points which aren't actually in the paper, which I'll highlight as well. So first of all, I'm going to talk a bit about the need for the paper, why I wrote it, why I thought there was a need for this. Talk a bit about market consistent valuation, really being a very hot topic at the moment. A bit about where ESGs fit in with solvency capital requirements, and then touch on ESG governance before we go into discussion. Before I start, one of my colleagues pointed out that there is an error in the paper, so if you've got a copy of it, in 552, FSA Pillar 1 Peak 1, which should of course be FSA Pillar 1 Peak 2. So if you've were confused by that, please don't read. So first of all, I just want to talk a bit about motivation for writing this paper. I've just obviously been involved in building and showing people through ESG models for quite a while now. I think it's fair to say that ESG models are very widely used in the UK insurance sector, especially in the life insurance sector. There are various commercial solutions available in the market, some which I think we're heavily involved in, and I'm sure that a lot of you will have those in your organisations as well. I think it's also fair to say that these models are being used for quite a few different applications, which we'll touch on shortly. There's various places in your organisations that will find people thinking about or using scenario generators. But then if we think about what the challenges are today, what we need to think about doing with ESGs going forward, I've made a few bullets there which are my list, if you like, where what we need to think about doing with ESGs. The first thing is market consistent valuation models to reflect some of the micro market features. A lot of you will have seen debate about liquidity premiums. One of the points I make in this paper is that the failure of ESG models and finance theory generally, that we rely on ESG models to pick up features like illiquidity. Another more practical issue with ESG models is actually getting them to fit your company view. Quite a lot of discussions with companies would be often focused around, well, we have this particular view, I think interest rates will look like this in 5 years and like this in 10 years. Actually making your ESG do what you want it to do and what your asset liability committee might want it to do is actually quite a challenge, and I think that's one of the key areas. There's another issue around understanding model risk as well. To what extent do you get a particular answer because you're using a particular model? If you use a different model, would you get a vastly different answer? I think that's a key area. And then I highlight at the bottom what I guess is the underlying issue that this paper is trying to address, and that is getting the ESG model embedded and understood in the company, including embedded into the governance structure of insurance companies. So in terms of using ESG models and where they tend to be used within insurance companies, these are my list of where I've seen them used. Obviously, we're very familiar with them being used for prudential supervision, both in PEEK 2 calculations and in ICA as well. Obviously, Solvency 2 is going to be a huge area where they're going to be used. And it's not just in the UK. If you look wider outside of Europe and even down to South Africa, ESGs are being used there for market consistent valuation and prudential supervision. Swiss solvency test is one of the obvious which springs to mind, and they're even being used in South Africa quite a lot now under the PGM 110 guidance. We also see them used in financial reporting, so EVs and MCV. They're widely used in asset liability management. Dynamic hedging as well is very much a growth area at the moment, with people thinking about how they go about doing internal hedges for their profits funds, or for example, in how they manage the risks around variable annuity products. They've often been used in product design. Actually, they were first used in anger in product design. That's one of the first places that insurance companies really started using ESG models in designing guaranteed products and trying to understand what the value of the guarantees was that they were writing. And also, to a lesser extent, been used in product communication as well, to actually trying to explain some of the risks and rewards associated with insurance products to the broker market. So this is, for some of you, this will be sort of ESGs 101, so I apologise for that, but I probably better put it in anyway. When we talk about ESG models, we actually talk about two different types of models we're talking about. There's risk-neutral models, which are used for market-consistent valuation. And their objective, the sole objective, raison d'etre, is to recreate market prices. And if you can recreate market prices, the thought is that you can recreate the market consistent value of your liabilities. There's a whole other genre as well, which are real world models. And their key objective is to capture the true dynamics of market prices. They will be used for projecting your balance sheet and understanding how much economic capital you need. In front of a sort of simple way of thinking what they would be used for, it's sort of they generally used for coming up with lots and lots of different, sometimes many thousand what-if scenarios. What could the world evolve into in economic terms in the next few years? So diving into the paper, one of the chapters that I've got is about why we might consider market consistent valuation to still be there. The reason that I put this in, despite the fact that Solvency 2 clearly mandates market consistent valuation, so in that sense we don't really have a choice over it, there's quite a bit of criticism about market consistent valuation. I'm going to sort of pick out some of those features now. But to start off that chapter, I put down these frequent misconceptions about market consistent valuation. And I apologise if these are not your particular misconceptions about market consistent valuation. But as an ESG modeler, these are the sort of questions that I might have been posed over the last 5 years. In fact, I've been posed all of these questions over the past 5 years. So the first one is that an arbitrage-free ESG model will, by itself, give market consistent valuation. And that's not true. If you were to just take a model out of a textbook, which you can do and code it up, that in itself doesn't give you what I would consider to be a market consistent valuation. The clue to why it doesn't is in point two, that an ESG model calibrated to deep and liquid market data will give a market consistent valuation. That neither will give you a market consistent valuation. It's really only when you combine those two, having a model with arbitrage through dynamics, and then calibrating that to deep and liquid market data. Those two things in combination are what gives you a market consistent valuation. Maybe just worth saying a little bit more around two there. I mean, it is possible to construct models which are not arbitrage free, and even to sort of calibrate those nominally to deep and liquid market data. And it's not always obvious that they are giving you dynamics to arbitrage in. So one has to be quite careful about when one's building models there. It's quite easy to convince yourself, actually, that you have built an arbitrage-free model when, in fact, you haven't. Point three is that market-consistent valuation gives the right valuation. And this is I put this in because there is sometimes a perception that, in some way, market-consistent valuation is some sort of holy grail and something's right and has some sort of definitive truth about it. I critique that quite strongly and say that basically what market consistent valuation as we practice it does is gives you a valuation and that has to be caveated with all the assumptions that have gone into that model. And those are assumptions about parameters and they're also assumptions about the way in which the market actually works. Another misconception that we come across occasionally is that market consistent valuation gives the amount of third party pay for a business. Actually, this is true. One of the things that you'll find, of course, when people do exchange parts of businesses is there's all sorts of intangible assets, intangible liabilities, which go into the transaction, often which are calibrated or calculated in a way that is much less sophisticated, I would say, than an ESG attempts to do. So it's important not to believe that the transaction price for moving one block of business from one place to another would necessarily be the same as the market consistent valuation. And five, having beaten up market consistent valuation throughout the first 4 points, we've kind of addressed the balance of it and say, well, I'm certainly not calling for a return to DCF style calculations. There is a misconception, this doesn't tend to come from the UK so much, but you might hear this view from the United States quite a lot. Market consistent valuation is no more objective than a traditional DCF technique using long-term subjective rates of return. In the paper, I make the argument that I don't think that's true. I think that despite its flaws, which we need to recognise, what market consistent valuation using ESGs, for example, does is to build up a value using some very clear assumptions about how economics works and what data you're using. And in that sense, it is a better way of coming up with a valuation than some of the techniques that we might have used in the past. So what are some of the criticisms that have been levelled at market consistent valuation? Well, one of the most strong criticisms has been that it basically creates a pro-cyclical capital regime. What we mean by that is that in a crisis, asset values fall, and your asset values on the balance sheet then marked down accordingly. At the same time, your liability values rise sharply as interest rates fall, for example, and as equity and private alternatives rise. Now, what that results in is that your own funds get squeezed from both sides, and you end up in a weak capital position, often relatively quickly. The other criticism is that what we're actually doing when we're doing market consistent valuation is importing marginal traded prices and stressed assets straight onto our balance sheets. I've got a graph in a second which will try and illustrate that point a bit more. And then the third point as well is that this squeezing of own funds effect that we see if we assume that procyclicality is going on can lead to asset fire sales. So insurers getting rid of risky assets in the markets all at once and then actually further pressing prices, which of course leads to negative feedback loop. Another criticism is liquidity premiums and other micro-market features that we might like to see are not reflected in market-consistent ESG models. And this is certainly true when you build an ESG model, you make a lot of brave assumptions about the fact that markets are deep and liquid and the transaction costs are zero. You also make lots of assumptions about tax as well, and that tax doesn't really come into play, particularly in pricing of assets. Point worth making is that when you actually do want to include liquidity premiums into an ESG model, you can't use the ESG model itself to tell you what that liquidity premium should be. You need some other model external to your ESG in order to infer what liquidity premium should apply. So I promised a graph about marginal pricing. This is one of my favourite graphs that I put around. This was Volkswagen. Some of you may remember there's a story about a year, I think 18 months ago, which was just towards the end of 2008, I think is when this happened, when for a short period of time, Volkswagen became the most valuable company in the world, apparently. They didn't do anything particularly, apparently it was a bunch of hedge funds and prop desks cornering the market, and I think Ferrari might have been involved in that as well. But regardless of the details, the point is that what the price that was quoted in the markets was a marginal price. It was the price at which those shares were trading on the margin, at which deals were going through on that particular few days. And you can see that the economic fundamentals, if you were to take that marginal price and extrapolate it to be the value of the entire company, it can give you a very misleading viewpoint. And the point of showing you this graph is that that is essentially what we're doing when we do ESG pricing. We're taking prices from the market, and we have to recognise that those are marginal prices. And if anything goes this happening in the market, if there are technical irregularities in the market, as indeed there were in this particular case, that can give us a misleading impression of what the value is of our company, of our liabilities, or of our assets. Another graph that I quite like to show is this VIX index that we have. And this is back from 1990. The VIX is a sort of average of option price implied volatility in the S&P 500 in the United States. And what you see is you get these occasional spikes in volatility when you have a market crisis, and we can see one there in around 1999, and of course the huge one up to about 80-85 on the VIX during the crisis at the tail end of last year. This is another thing that I think is going to come out over the next few months as people start to think about whether they really want to import or should be importing this sort of volatility into their balance sheets. So take, for example, the idea that if you happen to have a spike like this at the end of the financial year, potentially this would explode all of the value of options and guarantees on your balance sheet. And I think it's a question that we have to consider about whether that's an appropriate thing to do, or whether there is some illiquidity going on, whether there is some sort of technical issue with the market that means that we should perhaps ignore these very, very sharp spikes in implied volatility. We've had sort of said in CP39, if you look into the depths of that, it talks about in liquid market conditions, perhaps it's more appropriate to use historical volatility. And it looks like that in level 3 guidance there might be a bit more to say about that. Another thing that the paper talks about is why you would use an ESG at all. ESGs certainly aren't the only way of coming up with a market consistent valuation. There's also closed form solutions, and there's a couple of references in the paper to places that you can find those. Often what we tend to find is that the formulas that people can actually work down can often be quite simple, often too simple to capture all of the dynamics and complexity of life insurance liabilities. Also, quite often the underlying models can tend to be too simple. You often have to assume simple geometric random motions that all returns are normally distributed in order to be able to work through the mathematics and come up with these nice closed form solutions. And often, of course, that really isn't the case, and you're not capturing what's really going on underneath. It's worth mentioning replicating portfolios as well. Also, a lot of talk about those, and for a lot of people, maybe have projects looking at those or investigating whether you should be using them. Generally, these are not used for what I would call primary valuation, that is coming up with the balance sheet at time zero. What they are very good for is coming up with fast recalibrations, so understanding how your balance sheet has changed over the next 12 months in lots and lots of different scenarios. So it brings us back to stochastic ESDs and when they're best used. And when they're best used are really covered by these two bullet points. They're really useful when it matters how you get to a particular point over, say, the next 10 years. So if it matters how a market has moved over the course of a policy, rather than where the market ended up at the end of the policy, that means we have something called path dependency in our valuation, and that's where the ESDs really come into their own. It's also important where you have policies that depend on lots and lots of underlying variables. So if you have something that's just based on equity, it's easier to come up with a closed form than if you have something that's based on lots of equity indices, lots of different bond prices, on credit, on property, for example. That's what I call high dimensionality. And also, it's particularly useful where you have feedback loops as well. So if you have the cash flows from policies, for example, depend on policyholder behaviour, whether people have lapses of the policies, and if they depend on management actions as well, for example, management actions in response to the solvency of the company, then those also lend themselves much better to the stochastic approach that ESGs take to market consistent valuation. So finally, on market value, market consistent valuation, I'll just talk a little bit about the market value balance sheet and where we tend to apply ESGs and where we don't. So ESGs tend to lend themselves naturally to the valuation of good profits policies, with profits policies generally meeting all of the criteria set out on that previous slide. They're also widely used in continental participating products as well, continental with profits if you like, and also widely used on variable annuity products. It's difficult to see how you actually value a variable annuity product without using the ESG. ESGs lend themselves less to some, a lot of the other products that we see on our balance sheet, so pension products, for example, unit linked products, and general insurance products, and so to that I could add things like standard protection products like term assurance. There tends to be less of a need to use stochastic ESGs when valuing those sorts of products. I wanted to say a little bit about asset liability coherence as well, because this isn't something that always comes out a great deal, but I think it's something we're going to have to think a little bit more about when we do when we use solvency too. When you calculate a liability on liability by the side of the balance sheet using an ESG, there's certain assumptions which are going into that valuation. So if you were to look at the asset side of the balance sheet, you might have a derivative over there. And typically you're going to get that price directly from the market. You wouldn't use your ESG to value that derivative. But if you were to use your ESG to value that derivative, you might end up with a somewhat different price from the one that's actually stated in the market, simply because of approximations that have gone on in your ESG, or approximations in the assumptions that have been used. And so it's not completely obvious whether you set up your asset side of your balance sheet to be consistent with your ESG, or whether you make it exactly consistent with your market. Either way, you're going to have some sort of discrepancy there. The other two papers I just wanted to highlight were CPE40, for example, which, by mandating AAA government debt, introduces potentially a mismatch here between the way in which you mark your liabilities under Solvency II and the sort of assets that you might have for trying to hedge those liabilities on the asset side of the balance sheet, which will typically be marked to swap rates. Also, just making a note here about CP39 as well. If it happened to be the case that you had a liability and you were allowed to use historic volatilities to come up with a market consistent value for that, that isn't going to be the case when you look at the asset side of the balance sheet. So on the asset side of the balance sheet, if you have an offsetting derivative, for example, that was certainly going to be marked to imply volatilities if you were to go to the market and try and pick up the price. So there's another place that we have a mismatch between assets and liabilities on the Solvency II balance sheet. So I wanted to talk a bit about solvency capital requirements now and where ESGs tend to get used. So when we talk about solvency capital requirement, we're talking now about using real-world ESGs. Real-world ESGs for projecting balance sheet. Those will typically have risk premiums in them, certainly they'll have risk premiums. They'll have slightly different volatilities. They'll have realistic volatilities as opposed to implied volatilities. And these are the models where we're also more interested in capturing features such as tail correlations. By tail correlation, I mean where assets tend to fall in sympathy to each other. So they tend to be more correlated in when there's a sharp down moving in markets. And also fat tail distributions as well, that tend to be more widely used in real world ESGs. So the places where we might use these in capital requirements are, for example, in the standard formula. We might have to do a recalibration of our market consistent ESG and sequence stresses. And that can actually create quite a few challenges. Some of you who've been doing ICAs, for example, will maybe be using this approach. And it probably won't have failed to get your notice that when you change one bit of an ESG, something else often pops out the other side. So it's not untypical that you stress your swaption implied volatilities, for example, and then your correlations between equities and interest rates suddenly dropped by 20%, for example. And that's one of the things we have to bear in mind and think about documenting when we build ESGs under Solvency II. The other way that they're used is in partially internal models. There's a variety of different techniques that will be using ESGs for doing that. One is surface fitting, just calculating the sensitivities of the market consistent value balance sheet to various drivers and then using that to perform the surface. Replicating portfolios that are widely used in that as well. And also, some people will be using maybe full or partial nested stochastic approaches to their SCR. This isn't in the paper, but seeing as how this paper on partial internal models came out not long ago, I thought I'd pop it in as it's very topical. This is a lifted, pretty much straight out of the back of that paper, and shows you how you might think about building an ESG into a partial return model. And what you see there is a simple company with two strategic business units. And the way in which an ESG might be used is to put a little orange box around certain of those SCR stresses, and then essentially just use an ESG to come up with a single SCR stress for those particular stresses. And then you've got the issue of how you integrate that into the rest of the standard formula structure. One of the interesting things that comes out of this, if you have multiple business units, as in this particular example, is if you were to use the same ESG for each of these little market risk segments down here in orange, how does that affect the correlations that you use at the very top of the structure? Because presumably you would want to amend that because you've now got an inbuilt dependence between these two on the orange boxes. I'm not sure there's much drivers on that at the moment, but that's an interesting area of how we're going to apply partial internal models if we use ESGs across different business units. So one of the main aspects of running internal models is having to pass these tests, these seven tests which SciOps have put up for us. The use tests, the documentation tests, statistical quality, calibration, validation, and external models and P&L attribution. The ones I've underlined there are the ones I'm going to talk a little bit about tonight and the ones that we talked about in the paper. So if you think about the use tests, it'd be easy to say that the entire paper is really about how you apply the use tests around ESGs. But I just want to pick out two particular aspects of the use test. The first is this potential trade-off that you have between the use test and the validation test. So on the one hand, the use test is challenging you to ensure that your ESG and your wider internal model is actually understood within the company and is therefore used for decision making. And that, to some extent, necessitates something that isn't too complicated, so that enough people in the organisation can get their head around the model and can say, on the hand in their heart, yes, I trust this model, I trust what it's saying, in order to make strategic business decisions. On the other hand, you've got a validation test, which is targeted at making sure that your model is actually giving you as accurate a picture as possible. And if for an ESG, that means potentially building in additional complexity to the model. So there's going to be a natural trade-off and a balance here that people have to strike between having a model which is simple enough that they can understand it within the business, enough to make decisions off the back of it, but is accurate enough to satisfy the FSA and CIOPS, for example, that it is capturing the features of markets. Perhaps the important point to make is that there's this foundation principle underlying the use test, which is that there should be pressure to improve the model. So one could expect that one would have a starting position, which might be your current, the way that your ESG is currently set up, but then to have a process around that ESG to constantly challenge whether or not it's giving you accurate results, and then to gradually improve it each year. Another aspect of the use test is this reverse stress test application, coming up with the scenario that would lead you to ruin. Now, I suppose some people have approached this by taking a single one-step approach to this, so coming up with a single movement in interest rates, equity, property, that would lead you to the point of ruin. One of the things that ESGs can do in helping you to round that out is actually understanding the path to ruin. And I think this is one of the important lessons that came out of the banking crisis of 2008, is it isn't just one individual stress, one time zero, two time one stress that necessarily leads you to ruin. It's actually a cascade of events. One thing happens, that leads to another, and to another, and to another. And the only way of picking up that from a model is to have some sort of stochastic approach which has a whole variety of paths, and to explore those paths to see which ones led you to ruin and understand why they led you to ruin. One of the other tests is statistical quality. I think this is probably one of the largest sort of areas of CP56 that just came from. There's actually an awful lot in here that could apply to ESGs, and which could be maybe for quite a technical talk. I suppose the thing I just wanted to pick out particularly is data. There's these three tests around data: is it accurate, is it complete, and is it appropriate? If I pick out just the complete aspect of that, as an ESG modeler, the first thing that makes me think about complete is, should I be using all of the prices that are available to me in a market when I come up with, when I calibrate my ESG? Should I use all of the information, or do I have to throw some information away? If I think about a market consistent ESG for this particular example, there are an awful lot of auction prices out there that I could use to calibrate my model. But in practice, I might have to make some simplifications and not use all of the data, all of the auction prices that are available, just because I need a very complicated ESG to capture all of those. So there's an interesting trade-off around the statistical quality about what will be considered complete and what will not be considered complete. Under validation, one of the main things that comes out of the validation section is this idea of backtesting. And as an ESG modeler, I used to get this question all the time around 2008, is, did your model predict that then? Well, no, they generally didn't, of course, but it does raise the question, how do you do a backtest for modelling? Now, I talk a bit about this in the paper, about for a general internal model, backtesting in the same way that banks do backtesting, of their VAR models, for example, would involve going back each year and then running projection and working out whether or not what actually happened during the year was beyond the 1 in 200 event. And to some extent, banks can do that because they have a relatively short time horizon of a few days. So they can get quite a lot of data and they can come up with relatively robust, well, maybe not quite that robust, but in theory, they can get quite a lot of data and come up with a back test. Whereas for insurers with a 1 year time horizon, there aren't very many independent 1 year periods that you can do that for. So there's quite a few challenges when you come to back testing and meeting that particular requirement. Even for ESG models, it's quite challenging because we can't go back that many years before we start running out of some of the key data items that we use in our ESG modelling. There's also the calibration test, and one of the points I make in the paper around calibration test is that if you happen to have a risk measure, a longer term risk measure, which is maybe 10 year tail bar, for example, it's not obvious how to demonstrate to the FSA and CIOPS how that equates to a 1 year 99.5% bar. But that's what you have to do if you want to use a different risk measure. The ESGs are one way which you can do that, at least for market risk, by coming up with a model and a calibration which you believe in and calibrating it to various time horizons. It should be possible to at least have a reasonably good stab at demonstrating equivalence between two different risk measures. But in order to make this a little bit more topical, I thought I'd throw in this particular graph, which is from CP69. Now, calibration test is all about 1 year 99.5% bar, and you might think that what you have to do there is to, okay, you've got a particular stress test, but you stress test, and we have to basically make sure that whatever our risk tolerance is matches to that. However, CP69 is particularly interesting because I think it's the only place in the level 2 guidance where we suddenly have a stochastic stress test being introduced. And this is what we see here is this is the effectively the dampener on equities. The green line that you see going across here is a reverse engineered example of how the adjusted equity stress would work. So what we see here is we have it actually goes between minus 35 and minus 55. What this is telling us is that if we were to have had Solvency II in play, we'd have had a minus 55 stress test up until, say, about the middle of 2007, and it would have fallen away down to about minus 35. That's the first of about June 2008, and then it rose rapidly during the middle of this year. And the reason for showing you this in terms of calibration is it starts to raise some interesting questions when you're building your internal model. You might have a process in place for saying, okay, I'm comfortable that our risk measure is equivalent to 1 in 200 VAR. But now, certainly on equity, you need to start thinking about how you're going to make your risk measure adjust to what this risk measure is doing. And it'd be interesting to ask sort of CIOPS to get information from CIOPS about whether or not an internal model's stress test for equity will be benchmarked against this dynamic stress test, which is going to be used for the SCR standard formula. I want to say a bit about documentation standards. Sorry if this is a bit sort of documentation standards is the most interesting topic in the world, but I was assured by somebody that this is of great interest to the industry about how they're going to document their ESGs. So apologies if this is one that's particularly tedious. But what I've just listed through here is what I would expect to have an ESG to have in the way of documentation. I've tried to break it out in the paper into methodology and formula and parameters and the two other future developments and IT integration down the bottom. So in terms of methodology, places that I can see us needing to have documentation is first of all what I call the mathematical basis, and that is an argument for why the formulas that you've used to cover your ESG are actually valid. So for example, do have proof that they are actually arbitrage free, which you might just get from copying it out of a textbook and demonstrating the mathematics in that way. The second is a bit more tricky, and that's the empirical basis. That is the evidence that the way in which you've designed the model is actually capturing the true dynamics of the market which you're trying to represent. The third is assumptions, which is where you get your key assumptions from, for example, correlations and long-term volatilities. The fourth one is probably going to be pretty tricky, which is the application of expert judgments. There's always going to be some degree of expert judgment and subjectivity, even in ESG modelling, and how you've applied that and how you've demonstrated that you have that expert judgment was taken by a qualified individual is going to be a challenge. And perhaps the most important of all is where it doesn't work. And I think this is probably the area where most work has to take place. It's not normally the remit of people who are building ESG models to also provide you a document showing everywhere where it doesn't work particularly. But that's, I think, what's going to have to happen for Solvency II. There's going to have to be a lot of detail around where these models don't work, under what circumstances they break down, and to have that almost as a list on the side when you use the model, so that if you see certain economic circumstances arising which would lead you to believe that your model would fail, then you know those in advance and can take some action to maybe use a different model in those circumstances. There's also formulas and parameters. This is a bit more hand-turning, so methods for estimating parameters and the data policy and the source code will all need to be documented as well. So finally, I just wanted to talk a bit about ESG governance. I've got a chapter in the paper talking through from an ESG model's point of view how the governance of an ESG should look. Now, CP33, of course, talks about governance from CEOC's point of view and sets out what they would see as being governance, and that's set up in this diagram here on the left-hand side. In the blue box over on the right-hand side, I've got all the different functions which I talk about in my paper. The green box here is where the functions have a direct impact on the ESG function, as I would see it. And you can see that from CP33, you've got this actuarial function, which is largely around technical provisions, and a risk function, which is largely around looking after the risk management system, which is described. Whereas, for me, at least, thinking about ESG consultancy too, I would see actuarial and risk function being having pretty much the same role in ESG governance. I'd also see a role for something called an economist function, which comes up with the basis, the economic basis, which the company uses. I'd also see a lot of input here as well from the finance function and from the sales and marketing function. I'd see these two particularly as being key consumers of an ESG within an insurance company. So what I do in the paper is divide those up into what are producer functions and consumer functions. So on the producer side, we have an economist function, which is producing the economic basis. This is essentially setting out what the company's view is of future volatility, where the company thinks that interest rates and equity markets might end up. The risk and actuarial function, which is really the owner of the ESG model. This is where the expertise in how to use and operate the model comes from. And then the IT function as well. And I put the IT function in, this doesn't appear in many papers on governance that I see, but the more I talk to companies about how they're actually going to cope with Solvency II, the more it seems that IT and getting the IT side of things right is going to be of critical importance to success. And then I list three what I call consumer functions, first being the senior management and board, the finance function as well, which is a key consumer of what is going to be produced by the ESG for financial reporting, and then the sales and marketing function, which is particularly key, I think, because this is really where the manufacturing value for the insurance company, but also the place where most of the risk is being manufactured as well. So what I've got here is a couple of diagrams just to finish off showing a couple of the key relationships around an ESG governance structure. The first is around financial and risk reporting. The idea here is that you have an economist function which would come up with this economic basis. And they would be proposing that economic basis as opposed to definitively setting what it is. They would have a discussion with the senior management or the board to say this is what we propose, but ultimately it's got to be the senior management or the board who sign off on that and decide what the economic basis should be for the company. That's then fed through to the risk and actuarial function, who would then try and impose that on their model. But there needs to be a feedback loop there as well, because it's not obvious that anything that the economist function might come up with will necessarily fit into the models that the risk and actuarial function have. And so they might have to feed back to the economist function and say, well, this just doesn't work, I can do this, this, and this, but these other three conditions I can't meet. So there needs to be a dialogue there before finally there's an interaction when that's resolved with the finance function to say this is what the market consistent valuation looks like. And the second key relationship which I wanted to highlight is that in the manufacturing process. And in this scenario, we have the economist function coming up with an economic basis, then feeding that to the sales and marketing team, who, using their models, would then decide what they could manufacture, which would be profit-making for the company. You could expect that the sales and marketing function would have to have an interaction with the risk and actuarial function to check whether or not what they're producing is actually going to be profitable on the balance sheet as that's produced, and the risk and actuarial function would then report their findings up to senior management and board. But we'd also expect there would be some sort of interaction between senior management and sales and marketing as well, as they tell the senior management what they see happening in the market and discuss the sort of products that they'd like to launch into market as well. So that's all I had in terms of slides. I hope that was giving a sort of whistle stop tour of the paper.
Thank you very much, Alex. The discussion is now open to the floor, and I look forward to a very interesting and stimulating debate. I'd like to encourage as many of you as wish to contribute. To help the debate move around, if you've got lots of points you want to make, you can save them up and make them separately.